Eufy is sponsoring today's video. They reached out to me. I tested out their video lock. It is a game changer. I'm going to paint a picture for you for why I'm so excited to work with them. So you're getting home, your arms are loaded with groceries or packages or boxes or everything, and your keys are in your pocket. This drives me nuts. This happens all the time. I upgraded to the Eufy video lock, fingerprint, tap, I'm inside. And honestly, I also feel way safer. It's got this awesome built-in camera. So whether it's a package delivery or late night Uber order, I see exactly who's there right from my phone. There are no more mystery knocks. And the best part, this thing was such a breeze to set up. There's no wires, there's no drilling. There's also no monthly subscription fees. So if you are done fumbling with your keys, because I definitely am, search for Eufy Video Lock or head over to eufyofficial.com/video lock. Your front door, your sanity. Welcome to Success Story, the most useful podcast in the world. I'm your host, Scott D. Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. The HubSpot podcast network has other great podcasts you should go check out, like Being Boss, hosted by Emily Thompson. Now, with the holidays just around the corner, you're probably thinking, what's next for you in the new year? What other shows are you going to listen to level yourself up? Well, on the Success Story podcast, I interview a lot of entrepreneurs, and I usually dive deep into the creative aspects of building a business. So if you are a creative business owner, or you're thinking about eventually becoming one, which at some point everybody kind of has to be because you have to be a little bit creative in how you build a business, how you market a business, and how you sell your product, all of that does require some creativity, but also for people that are hyper-focused on the creative niche. You may be interested in Being Boss, hosted by Emily Thompson. Being Boss is an exploration of not only what it means, but what it takes to be a boss as a creative business owner. If you are into some of the following topics, you're going to love this show. Project management and building systems for creatives, freelancers, or side hustlers. Opening a retail store. Rituals that inspire and evoke creativity, and taking time off as a business owner to focus on yourself, your creativity, and upskilling. You need to listen to Being Boss. They cover all these topics and more. You can listen to Being Boss on any of your favorite podcasting platforms or at hubspot.com/podcast network. Today, my guest is Joe Foster. He is the founder and former CEO of Reebok. Joe founded Reebok in 1958 with his late brother Jeff following their family heritage back to 1895. Joe's grandfather, also Joseph W. Foster, pioneered the spiked running shoe and famously made shoes of some of the world's best athletes of the early 20th century. Wearing pumps made by J.W. Foster and sons, Harold Abrahams and Eric Liddell won Olympic gold medals in the 1928 Paris Olympics and were immortalized in the film Chariots of Fire. With Reebok, Joe and Jeff followed in their grandfather's footsteps, creating footwear that led to Olympic Commonwealth, European medals, and world record-breaking performances, and over time became the globally recognized brand that we know and love today. Joe wrote the book Shoemaker that highlights and speaks about his journey. It speaks about his entrepreneurial journey, how they came up with the idea for Reebok, where the name Reebok came from, how he had to adopt a certain mindset in order to make Reebok a success, some of the highs and the lows that he experienced in his life and his journey, how he brought Reebok from Europe over to the US, some lessons there and why it was so important ultimately for the success of the company, and then just some experiences and some insights that he's garnered from an incredible career and an incredible success. This is Joe Foster, founder and former CEO of Reebok.
Oh, Scott, thank you so much for the invitation. It's wonderful, and it really is great to be able to tell the story. And you more or less laid it out. It really did start. You know, we knew very little. Jeff and I knew very little about our grandfather. And surprisingly enough, it was just to us as growing up local business. And we didn't know until we got Reebok. I mean, we were well down the road with Reebok before we had a little bit of money, some time. We could get somebody to really dig into the family history. And it's remarkable. But of course, we didn't have communication like we have today. So that story didn't really get out and about. And writing the book more or less enabled me to tell the truth, because, you know, we've been looking at reports on Google, Wikipedia. This is how Reebok started. You know, Reebok was this and Reebok. And there's even a photograph, I think it's in Google, maybe in Wikipedia, of Joseph Foster, the founder of Reebok. I have not a clue. I don't know who he is. And you think, better get this down on writing. So some 7 years ago, I sat down and decided, we were living in Tenerife at that time, which is the Canary Islands. We spent some time there. And nice, relaxed, start writing, get the computer out. Probably if I'd had to do it longhand, maybe, or even on a typewriter, but with a computer, you can do lots of things. And so I started simply to begin with, to put the story straight. But, you know, once you start going, you start remembering things and well, this happened and this happened. So the story started to grow from memory. The only thing I had was chronological, you know, the chronological order of some of the stuff. Okay, grandfather I knew, we'd got all that. But my own experiences, we needed some chronology. But yes, grandfather, he started way back in 1895. He was only 15, pretty young. But I suppose in those days, 15, you know, you'd finish school. Yeah. Well, you finished school probably at 10 years old, and that was it. So at 15, he was a cobbler. He was also a member of his local athletic club in the northwest of England there. And it obviously struck him that, well, maybe if I put some spikes in the bottom of my shoes, I might improve my running results. And you know, he got this idea from his grandfather. So, but his grandfather didn't know anything about running, didn't know anything about running shoes. His grandfather was a cobbler, quite some distance away, probably 50 miles. So 50 miles away in those days in the United Kingdom, he had to do some traveling to get there. But he went to see his grandfather. And his grandfather, a cobbler, not only repaired street shoes, he also repaired cricket boots. Now, cricket boots in those days had spikes in the bottom. And of course, probably my grandfather, Joe, said to his grandfather, why have they got spikes in? Why? Well, give them grip. Ah, okay. So that was probably his light bulb moment. And he thought, give them grip. I could do with a pair of something with spikes in to give me grip when I'm running. And in those days, cinder tracks. So spikes would have been great. And so coming back, he made himself. But I mean, the story goes that really he hand-soled one of the soles on, but he was so impatient with the other sole, he nailed it on. And I think that came off in his first race. But apart from that, that was the start. But, you know, what he seemed to know is today sort of commonplace, and that's influencers. He knew something about influence, and he used to give his shoes to, obviously, to leading runners. And by 1904, he had three world records in one race. Hmm. It was a one-hour race, and the guy, Alf Shrub, he broke three world records during 1 hour in one race. So that was his beginning. Also, he got lots of gold medals in that first decade of the 20th century. But then, of course, we had 1914, 1918, World War One. Unfortunately, nobody wanted running shoes in during the war. But the 1920s came along. And as you said, you know, he had Eric Liddell, Harold Abrahams, and he got Lord Burley. I think Lord Burley, he earned his gold medal either before or just after Liddell and Abrahams. And all three of them were in Chariots of Fire. So he made their shoes, and he gave shoes to many leading athletes. And he did lots and lots of gold medals. And you know, we learned this. And I have a file of the advertising he used to do in newspapers throughout the UK and some magazines. And it's incredible. The file is about 4 inches thick of all these adverts. And some of them are quite cheeky, but most of them just say so-and-so won this race. And all these top leading athletes were winning races in his shoes. Unfortunately, grandfather died in 1933, I was born in 1935, some 15 months after he died. And as you've already said, since I was born on his birthday, 15 months after he died, they call me, I came with my name. Grandmother insisted. She was qualified. She insisted. He brought his name with him, and that was it. I didn't know any difference. And my mother didn't like the idea that I'd be called Joe. I don't know what she wanted to call, but not Joe. You know, the family, my grandfather's business, which he set up in 1900, was J.W. Foster and Sons. And all the family, J.W. Foster. My brother was Jeff. I had a younger brother, John. My father was James. And my uncle was John, all with the William. So
purposely done?
Purposely done, yes, purposely done. When I had children, there were no JWs. In fact, Jeff married a Jean and I married a Jean. So, and we were living together. We lived together in the factory premises. We lived together. So can you imagine the mail when it comes in? Two JWs and two Js. So, you know, it was confusion. It was a lottery as to who opened the letter. Anyway, that's what happened. But say we didn't continue with the JWs beyond that. I think it was a sort of tradition in those days. And so I'm born in 35. By 1939, 4 years later, we have another World War. We're in World War II. And for 6 years until 1945, there were no lights on. You know, we're kids. We're growing up. You don't know any difference. It's exciting. No lights. What? Running around the streets. And we had things like double summertime. So it was light forever. And up until 1945, when the war was over, wow, the lights come on. Things change. And really, probably education started then. We did have education during the war, but it was in the front room of some teacher's house. And not really, no consistency to it. But by the time I was 10, we were in full education. And I went to college, which I had 2 years in college, 3 years in college. And I left at 17 to join the family business. Family business was by this time being run by my father and uncle. And only 1 year before both Jeff and I happened to be at the same time off to do national service. It was mandatory. We had no choice. We both have national service. 2 years of national service, which was, I think, it's probably the making of our sort of the reason why we decided in the end to set up our own business, because we went away and we spent 2 years away from family. You know, mother's not getting you up in the morning, doing your washing, making your meals. You've no one to refer to. You learn how to be independent. Mm-hmm. And you learn the best ways of being independent, how to do things. For 12 months of my 2 years, I spent just playing badminton. At that time, I was reasonable at badminton. Obviously, good enough to play for the, I think it was the, well, we were fighter command in the RAF. I played fighter in the RAF. So, yeah, enjoyed that. We came back, though, from national service. And Jeff had been in Germany. In Germany, he'd seen Adidas and Puma, and he came back, and we're talking, and we're looking at the business, and it's failing. It's going nowhere. They're making the same shoes made in the 1930s and early 40s, and we think, why? And, the reason was that my father and my uncle were a bit like Adi Dassler and Rudi Dassler. They feuded. They fought. They were 6 years apart in age, and they didn't get on. To this day, I don't know why, you know. And so the business really wasn't progressing. My father was looking after machine sewn work, and my uncle looked after the hand-sewn shoes. Work, which were the shoes that grandfather had started making. And there were also the shoes that were sent into Yale University. Yale used to buy 200 pairs a month from Foster's, and they distributed them through USA. So I knew at that time that USA was a good market, but the company was failing. It wasn't moving on. orders were less and less. And, you know, I took this up with my father. I said, look, we've got to progress. And we've got to change this. We need a plan. We need to do some marketing. No. And all he could say is, look, when I'm gone and you, my uncle's gone, this business will be yours. And I'm saying, Dad, but number one, we don't want you to go. You know, we're not looking for you to go anywhere. You know, we prefer you to be around. But number two, this business will have gone. There will be no business. Still didn't listen. So Jeff and I, by 1958, we'd made our plans. We thought if they can't change, we'd have to change. And so in 1958, we left the business and set up our own little business, Mercury Sports Footwear. And Mercury Sports Footwear, brilliant. And we were doing fine. We were doing fine for 18 months. And we were making some money. Fine, making money. Then our accountant, he came and he said, look, guys, you're doing well, but you'd better register that name. You know, I was 23, Jeff is 25, or by that time, probably 24, 26. I was saying, why? I said, well, if somebody else starts and thinks you're making good shoes, they're good, and they start making Mercury footwear, you're going to have a lot of trouble. Because you're going to have to prove that that's your name. Well, what do we do? Well, you go and see a patent agent, and the patent agent will check the register for you. And so we did. I went along to see a man in Manchester, and he checked out the name Mercury, and it was already pre-registered. Ah, you know, we're making a living. It's nice. We'd like the name. Nothing wrong with that. And we also had the winged messenger as our logo. Right. So our agent said, well, I've been in touch with the people. That was Lotus and Delta. They were part of British Shoe Corporation, a big corporation. And they'll sell it to you for £1,000. £1,000? We'd set up our whole factory on about £250. We hadn't any money. We couldn't find £1,000, and it's like impossible. Okay, he said, so you'll need to change, and if you need to change, you'll need to give me 10 names, at least 10. And I puzzled him, why 10 names? He said, well, we've got to check the register, and it's surprising how many names are already pre-registered. And he pointed through his window. It was open, it was nice May Day, sun was coming in there. He pointed through his window to Kodak. And I'm saying, Kodak, what's with Kodak? He said, well, that's a made-up name. You know, they invented the name. So it's theirs. They've registered it. It's invented. Any name that you bring along, if it's already there, if it's a name you pick, it might already be pre-registered. We don't know. Okay. So we go back and sit around the table. Look, we need a new name. So we're thinking Cougar, Falcon. These are aggressive names. Feels good. Yeah, feels good. Let me take you back to 1943. 1943 is the middle of the war. And like COVID, nobody can really go anywhere. We're all more or less staying at home. And but we had events. And at a local event, I won an 60-yard race. I won the race. Of course, I had an advantage. Foster's wear spikes. So I had spikes on, which was quite an advantage to the rest of the kids that I was running against. But I won. Fantastic. Right. I go up to collect my prize. And yes, here's your prize. What's my prize? A dictionary. Yeah, a dictionary. Where's the football, guys? You know, I'm a kid. I want to play football. a dictionary. And at the time I didn't know it, but it was an American dictionary, a Webster's. And you probably know Webster's dictionary. I mean, that's.
Of course.
Common.
It's a known name.
Right. And as we know, American spelling of one or two names is different. You know, we have color, labor, they all have a U in it, in the UK and don't have a unit in America. So I'm supposed to learn how to spell things, and I've got an American dictionary in addition. Okay, this is fine. Put it at one side. So fast forward now. Now we're back into 1960 and a problem to find a name. We brighten all these down. But I had my dictionary there, and I liked the letter R. Thought, good, strong letter. Open the book, and turn to R. Let's start thumbing through from R. Sooner I'm at R, double E, B, OK. What's that? Small South African gazelle. Gazelle. Wow. Fantastic. That's got to be it. Put that at the top of the list. And it's hard to believe me. Okay. Now, if I had been looking at an Oxford English dictionary, I would have had that spelled R-H-B-O-K or even R-H-O-B-O-C-K. So, you know, it was like, I may have just passed that by. But so fortunately, I had an American spelling of a small gazelle. And I took this to the agent, and he checked out all the names. And Reebok was the only name that came out, because I'd said to him, look, we need this one. We're in love with this, and we've got to be in love with it, because it's got to be our passion. But it was the only one that came out. There was one caveat, and that was from the registrar, who said, we can only put it in Part B of the register. And why Part B? What's that? What's the difference? Well, he said, if anybody makes shoes out of Reebok skin, we can't stop them saying these are Reebok. And Jeff and I, we looked at each other and thought, is that going to happen? Yeah. We'll go with Reebok. And 20 years later, we got a letter from the registrar to tell us that now Reebok had been moved from the B section to the A section. And the reason was that everybody now knows that Reebok is a shoe and not an animal. But that's how it became Reebok.
That's an amazing story. Thank you so much. And you carried the story, and you didn't force me to ask a lot of questions that I wouldn't have known to ask. So I appreciate you telling that over. And obviously your portion of the story you knew well. And that's an incredible story. And I didn't know that story behind Reebok. But you also discovered a lot of interesting things behind your grandfather and whatnot when you wrote Shoemaker. And were there certain you alluded to it, but was there certain things that you discovered that basically you tapped into that were key in some of the learnings that you've implemented in the company? You mentioned even, for example, perhaps.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Masterworks. Most millionaires do this. Listen, after interviewing over 200 entrepreneurs and investors, highly successful people, I've discovered they all do one thing in common. To become a millionaire, you have to invest like one. But that's easier said than done. Because the truth is, investments in luxury real estate deals, lucrative pre-IPO deals, and hedge fund products are closed off to 97% of Americans. The odds are stacked against you. But there's a new app that lets everybody invest like the ultra wealthy. It unlocks a massive $1.7 trillion opportunity that to date has been closed off to investors. It's one that millionaires use to not only grow their wealth, but protect it. And for good reason. This asset beat the S&P 500 by 174% from 1995 to 2020. What I'm about to say might surprise you, but what I'm talking about is contemporary art. Masterworks, which is New York City's newest $1 billion unicorn, gives you the opportunity to invest in the same type of art as the world's richest individuals, including works by legends like Banksy, Basquiat, and Warhol. Demand for Masterworks offering is higher than ever. Luckily, I've partnered with Masterworks to get VIP access to Skip to the Front. To secure your spot, head to masterworks.io/success story. That is masterworks.io/success story. You can skip to the head of the line and start investing in contemporary art that the ultra wealthy invest in. To see important disclosures, go to masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Moving away from innovation, like moving towards innovation, understanding the ability to go into new markets when perhaps your father or your grandfather didn't. These were all sort of lessons learned that you took into the company. And I guess you probably discovered more when you did more research. So I guess the two ways I want to take this. First, I want to understand some of the interesting things that perhaps you did discover about your grandfather, just at a high level. We don't have to go into too much detail and tell more stories. But then I also want to understand some of the insights that you took from your father and your grandfather when you're building out the company, going into American markets, innovating and trying new things, and all these other things that have made Reebok successful, and some of those learnings that you could probably teach over. So first, I would say, what did you learn about your grandfather outside of what you had already known?
Well, I guess we knew we started the company, but what we didn't know is who he'd supplied. All these athletes, and they were really leading athletes. And I think that woke us up to the fact that if you're going to be successful, you're going to need to be a winner. You're going to need to be seen to win things. And in athletics, it's races. So he had shoes on people winning races. And we know that some would buy them. But even back then, in the early 20th century, you know, giving away shoes, and he did, because in his adverts, he actually gave them to somebody who was a writer, sort of an athletics writer who was writing for the a reporter for the news. And this reporter actually wrote a report that, you know, I've just received this pair of shoes from Joe Foster, and I must admit they're the best shoes I've ever worn. So he knew how to promote his product. You know, right now we have computers and we have mobile phones. We're able to communicate. Social media, it's everywhere now. But in those days, no. You just had local events advertising in race events and magazines. I mean, as far as the UK was concerned, at that moment in time, it was an empire. Now it's a Commonwealth. But as an empire, whatever magazines were sort of printed and issued in the UK would go out to Canada, would go to Australia, New Zealand, India, Africa. And people would write in because the adverts were always say, please write for our illustrated catalogue. And a lot of people in these different countries learning English, this is part of the way to learn English, they would be given these magazines and they would write for an illustration. And so, in fact, it's quite funny because when these letters came in from abroad, my father and uncle, they used to cut the stamp off and stick it on the wall next to the desk. And that must have been 2 meters square. It was massive. All these things. I wish I could have it today. I wish I could go back and see that wall today because it would be worth a fortune. It was absolutely incredible how many different from all around the world. I mean, about 150 countries belong to the empire, just even small little islands. So all these islands have their own stamps. But so we learned that communicating and sort of influencing, you need to get athletes. But we're learning this from what grandfather was doing. We thought, well, you know, we've got a lot to do to equal what he achieved. And yeah. He obviously didn't, my father and my uncle did not carry on that spirit, that business. Maybe two world wars, they'd have lived through World War One, World War Two. Maybe two world wars took away the energy.
Inspiration, the energy, yeah.
Yeah. Took that away from them to sort of create a business, because by that time, they're probably in the late 40s, early 50s. Not the time to start sort of building things, I suppose. You know, they were settling the business. It would bring in a nice living, and that's how they were. So we had to sort of think again. No, you build a business. It won't build itself. And I used to go out on the water, sell into the retail shops in different towns all over the UK. And And okay, I did quite well, but so many shops I would call in, and I say, I'm Reebok, and most of them would say, who? Reebok. Okay, bringing the shoes out, and this is, you know. And they'd look at me and they'd say, look, I've got Adidas, and I've got Dunlop. Why do I need Reebok? And that to me was a very important question. And I think it came up two or three times before it hit me. Why do they need Reebok? They don't. They don't need Reebok. They've been running their shop and being successful and making money well before Reebok was around. So they don't need Reebok. So at that time, we decided we'd go to the athletes. So we went to race meetings with shoes in the car, and we sold. And we became very much involved in the athletic scene as people who produced the right sort of footwear. And also, in the UK, we had the Amateur Athletic Association, the 3As, and they produced a handbook. And that handbook was about 300 to 400 different clubs, and we had the name and address of every secretary. So that was an opportunity. Write the letters. So the letter went to each one. We offered them a 15% discount, and our business started to grow. At that point then, the retailers that I'd been calling on, they were phoning me and saying, you're supplying some of our athletes, the local athletes, and, you know, we'll stock your shoes if you stop selling to the athletes. Oh, well. I said, look, we'll deliver to you at a wholesale price. The athletes only get 15% off. And we'll also advertise that you're one of our distributors if you want, but we're not stopping selling direct because that's our marketing. 90% of these guys agreed. And so that's how our business grew in the United Kingdom. But, you know, athletics is a small business. The big business is in the UK is soccer. Football, we got. Soccer's a big business. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, we go back to grandfather, and he was supplying almost every, I think there's only one or two teams, almost every football or soccer team in the United Kingdom. Including rugby teams. And there were 96 that he was supplying direct. He used to supply them. And we just wondered what happened. How did father and uncle lose that business? But we'd lost it. It was now in the hands of Adidas. To get in there, we didn't have that much money. To get in there, we would have needed a lot of money because by that time, Adidas was starting to pay people. And the soccer scene, football scene, beginning to influence street. You could see the kids on the street with replica shirts, footballs, and also training shoes. We needed to go bigger. How do we get bigger? Well, that came back to my experience with Foster's and America. Why not America? That's a big market. In America, you've got colleges, universities. Mm-hmm. They all have coach. Coaches are God. And you can go there on a sports scholarship. That's got to be a big market. 1968, I'm reading a magazine. It's a sporting magazine. There's an advertisement in there from the British government saying that we want you to export. And we will get you a stand at the NSGA show. That's the National Sporting Goods of America in Chicago. We'll organize a stand for you. We'll pay for your return airfare, and we'll pay half of your expenses, your hotel, and whatever. Well, it's like going for a holiday, that, and somebody paying.
Let's do it.
yeah, get on with it. No. So, yeah, well, that was 1968. You know, I had a word with a friend of mine who, he was in the outdoor industry, we were in the sports, but we were making a climbing boot for him, a rock climbing boot, and he said, yeah, I'll come along. Let's go together. And went out to Chicago. Well, first of all, went into New York, and we visited the sports store. I visited sports stores. He visited outdoor stores, just having a look what the business was like. Then onto Chicago, onto the stand. And, okay, lots of people there. Lots of people love the shoes. And they're saying, well, where'd we get these from? After in England. Here's the card. And they're saying, is that New England? No. It's the old England, the one near London. across the sea. Well, they love the product, but they said, look, when we can get the product here, if we can buy it in the States, we'd love to give it a try. This is 1968. It was 1979 before I got that distribution in America. 11 years, 6 complete failures. 6 times I was there with one guy. I was there for 4 years trying to get in, knock on the door. But it was the same with the problem I had with the retail business, with the retail sports stores in the UK. Why did they need Reebok? They didn't. They didn't need Reebok. It was, yeah, they'd try it, they'd give it a go, but they didn't need Reebok. I had to make them need again. Fortunately, it was Runner's World. Running during the 70s, running became a massive business. It really took off. And with it came Runner's World. I don't know if it was Runner's World that created the business, because Runner's World started as a small, one single page A4. That was Runner's World. By 1975, it was a 100-page glossy, full glossy magazine with everything in the events, where they were going to take place, people who run events. And Bob Anderson, who was the publisher, he was so influential that he decided he could tell people, what's the best shoe? What is the best running shoe? And he did. And he said, this is the number one running shoe. And it was a Nike running shoe. Well, you can think of Phil Knight. Phil Knight probably died on the spot of thinking, wow, fantastic. We've got the number one shoe. Then it would strike him. How do I meet the orders? Because, you know, you're 350 million people in the USA, and probably 40 million were going out running. And 4 million would probably like to get the number one shoe. So they place an order with Nike for a shoe. Could Nike, you know, could they get a shoe? No. Because Nike's, they're bringing them in from Japan. And, you know, the demand, suddenly probably Phil Knight is placing orders for 250,000 pairs. He'd probably been placing orders for 20,000 pairs. Now, and he's trying to get his production up so that he can meet the potential orders that the retailers were demanding for him. If you've been in business producing an item like a running shoe and trying to wind up that business to meet that demand, that takes almost a year just to get it going off the ground. And so by the time Phil Knight and Nike had got the shoes, or were getting the shoes in, and the retailers were getting the shoes for their customers, Bob Anderson, we've gone 12 months, we're going to have another number one shoe. And this was a different shoe. Oh. So by this time, the business, the retail business, in total disorder. Tons of shoes were coming in. All of a sudden, there's a new number one shoe. Everybody changes to the next. Oh, we want the number one shoe, not last year's shoe. So this was obviously a problem for the whole retail sports shoe business. And it was a problem for Bob Anderson, which he created. So he changed. And he changed to a star rating. So instead of having a number one and a number two shoe, you could be 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 stars, whatever. And 5 stars meant you could have 4, maybe more shoes than 5-star shoes. That would be something. And guess what? I knew how to make a 5-star shoe. I knew I could do that. Making a number one shoe, too big a gamble, because you know, the number one shoe, when you've got Nike, New Balance, Etonic, and there's a lot of competition on the market. But I knew we could get a 5-star shoe. And by 1978, we'd made Aztec. And Aztec was to become a 5-star shoe. Aztec we tested out in the Commonwealth Games in Edmonton. And we got a bucket load of medals. We did really well in Edmonton. But then in February 1979, the shoe edition for Runner's World comes out in August. But running is getting that big now that Kmart come along, and they said, we want 25,000 pairs. Well, our factory, little factory back in England, we could it'd take us 6 months. That's 6 months for our factory. But we knew that. We knew we'd, you know, we knew we'd, knew if we got a five-star shoe, and that's what we were absolutely certain we could do, we knew we'd need help. And I had friends in the industry, and one of my friends was at Barter, and Barter said, yeah, we'll help. We can make your shoes. But then came out and said, yeah, but we need a better price. Oh, that we were also, we were aware of the fact that the whole business would go into the Far East, that they could make them at less than half the price we could make them. Mm-hmm. Right. But I had a contact in London who was sourcing from the Far East. So again, we could meet that if we got that five-star shoe. Right. That's great. So also the...
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Manly Bands. Guys, engagement season is in full swing. Jewelry stores are going to be filled with grooms that are nervous, throwing words around like cut, clarity, color. And in the middle of all of this chaos, it is super easy to forget about your band. Manly Bands is here to make your band buying experience way easier. And they're not going to put you through the stress that you went through when you had to figure out hers. Manly Bands offers you the freedom for your hand to look how you want it. They have roughly every type of earthy material available and even some from space. They have meteorite, carbon fiber, Damascus steel, wood, antler, and even dinosaur bone as an option for your band. I ordered one, the material, the color, the different customization options. It's the only place I've ever found that gives a man this many options when it comes to ordering a band for himself. So if you want to check these out, you have to go to manlybands.com/success story. If you don't know your ring size, you can order their Manly Ring Sizer. It includes 26 plastic holes and half sizes from size 5 all the way through to size 20. They'll also give you the option to customize your band from scratch. Of course, you can buy some of the previously designed bands on their site, but you can choose the style, material, inlay, sleeve, engraving, and finish. With Manly Bands, you shop with confidence. They provide free warranty, a 30-day exchange policy. They ship their rings for free worldwide, and they also include a free silicone band if you want to use that when you go to the gym, for example. On top of that, they're running a huge sale. From now until Cyber Monday, they're giving you 25% off. So whether it's a first band or an upgrade, go to manlybands.com/successstory or use promo code successstory when you're checking out to get 25% off through Cyber Monday. That's 25% off Manly Bands at manlybands.com/successstory or use promo code successstory.
At the 1979 exhibition at NSDA show there, I met Paul Fireman. Paul Fireman was there with his Boston Camping, a small wholesale camping outfit, Boston Camping. And he came along, and immediately I liked the guy. If someday I could get on with, you know, I'm thinking, Kmart, that's going to be a tough one. Yeah, 25,000 pairs. But if you don't meet the turnover that they require for a square footage in the stores, that'll be your first order and your last order. Paul Fireman liked him. And he could see, by the way, he was rather tired of the same business he'd been in for 10 years. He's in the business with his brother and his brother-in-law, and they were selling tents, fishing rods, camping equipment. And you could see that wasn't growing. It wasn't going anywhere. He was doing the same business he'd done for the last number of years. And he said, Joe, I'd love to be a distributor, but we need a five-star shoe. I said, Paul, come. See, look. Paul said, come on, Joe. But yeah, that's not a five-star shoe yet. I said, not yet. No, not yet. But this is going to be a problem. And Paul said, look, I believe you, but we really need it to be a five-star shoe. And I said, fine. So we went our ways, and I visited the States. I went to see Kmart. They were in Detroit. And from there, I went on to see Paul. Paul picked me up from the airport and took me to his Boston Camping. Nice outfit. Yeah, great stuff. Yeah, nice little business here. And then Paul came to the UK. He was really disappointed with the size of our factory when he saw it. Yeah, small factory. I said, don't worry, Paul. We've got this and we've got this. You know, the factory is, this is how we make our start in life. But and he wanted to go to some races to see just, you know, how many Reebok shoes were sort of around. And yeah, well, it doesn't take you to be a genius to understand that every race we took him to was won by Reebok. And at least 25% of the people taking part were in Reebok. So, yeah, but I guess Paul also knew that. But at least it proved to him that Reebok was around, and that was great. So we're waiting for the August edition, for the issue edition. And this was out the last week in July, and I phoned Paul. It's probably a bit early in the morning because I think it was about midday in the UK, which would be about 7 o'clock in the morning in Boston. So it was a bit dozing. I said, Paul, look, Runner's World Edition will be out now. Can you nip down to one of the kiosks and find out how we did? Oh, all right. An hour later, Paul came back and said, Joe, I say, you're 5 stars. Oh, fantastic. Yes, big smiles all around. That's it. He said, but I mean, Aztec was a trainer, and that was a volume shoe. But he said, you also got 5 stars for Inca, which was a spike shoe, and also for Midas, which was a racing shoe. So we got 3 5-star shoes to enter the US market.
Amazing. And then obviously that's when supply chain, Kmart, all this stuff is starting to come together, and then now you can fulfill all these 25,000 plus orders. And that was the first major sort of like foray into the US markets. That was the first successful foray, correct?
Successful, yes. Not the first foray. I tried that on numerous occasions. There's a guy in California, there's a guy in Philadelphia, Cincinnati. I had a guy in Cincinnati. Oh, I'd been all over the place. We tried very hard to get in. But the difference was, and it's a bit like we're saying with the British sports trade, I had to make them want me by going to the athlete. On this occasion, the hook was a 5-star shoe. When we got a 5-star shoe and it became something big in Runner's World, that was it. The demand was there. We got the hook. So that was the big difference for us to get into the American market, which was fantastic. But so I'm dashing across the Atlantic again, going seeing Paul. Paul again picks me up, and we go drive down to his office. And I said, "Where's Boston Camping?" Well, oh, we quit. They just stopped the business. That was it. I knew he wasn't that keen, but I thought this would be a bolt-on to the business. It would be nice to, no. Paul took Reebok. His brother went making wallets, snap wallets, they were called at the time, with and fabric. And his brother-in-law had opened a second-hand car lot. But all of a sudden, I'm thinking, oh, you know, we're okay. So this is Paul. This is Reebok, and okay. So that is a start. That's amazing. But I mean, it took a lot of guts from Paul to do that. You know, said it. But he was obviously very hungry. He obviously needed something. He needed to get out of what he was in, and in a way, that probably was better. The fact that this had to succeed. Yes, now, yeah, it got his whole attention. Most of the guys I'd been with before trying things, they all had an income. You know, they all were working at something, and this would be something they'd try. So I guess when it got tough, it was easy to say, no, it's not working for me. And so we pulled out. But right, now we have a nice business, and it's going great. But we had a guy down in LA, Arnold Martinez. And Arnold's wife he was a tech rep, and he used to go around, and you know, a tech rep just shows, you know, what he can do with the shoe. He was a good athlete himself, was Arnold. I think he'd once done a trial for the Olympics, but I don't think he quite made it. But his wife is coming home after being to aerobic classes. And she's full of it. She'd got a friend with her, and they were all full of this. And Anne says, what are you doing? And she said, well, these aerobic classes, they're fantastic. And I looked, aerobics, what's that? And she said, well, it's exercise to music. Oh, well, next time you go, I'm going to come down and have a look what you're doing, which he did. What do you see? He sees an instructor wearing trainers. Half the class wearing trainers, the rest just in bare feet. And I think that was a fantastic light bulb moment for Arno. Why don't we make a shoe specifically for these girls? Wow, this would be good. So Arno is on the next flight to Boston to meet Paul Fireman. And he said to Paul, look, it's a fantastic thing. This is new. It's really going to be fantastic. And it's going down in Los Angeles, the girls, and Paul is saying, whoa, slow down. Slow down. What do you mean? What? You want us to make shoes for you? Yeah. No, look, we're a running company. We're doing very nicely with running, and we're growing very nicely. Why do we need to think about making a few shoes for some girls down there in LA? And Arnold is saying, look, honest, Paul, this is going to be big. Paul said, calm down, don't worry. Arnold wasn't put off though. He went to the back door. He went to see Steve Liggett. Steve Liggett was in charge of manufacturing. And he was very persuasive, obviously, because he persuaded Steve to produce him 200 pairs of shoes, specifically for women, on a woman's last. Okay, he got his shoes. He went back down to LA and he gave these shoes to the instructors and to some of the girls out there. And they love them. Absolutely love them. Few manufacturing problems to begin with because we were using glove leather, and glove leather just tears too easily. So it had to be backed up with nylon and different things. But anyway, it was the girls in LA didn't worry. You know, If they only got 3-4 weeks out of it, they'd go buy another pair. They love them that much. And then Jane Fonda, she started doing her videos, fitness videos, wearing Reebok. And she'd obviously bought them. So, wow. But, you know, the girls weren't just wearing them for aerobics. They were going to work in them. They were going out in them. They were enjoying life. And all of a sudden, this thing just exploded. We were a $9 million company by then. That was our revenue. The year later, we were $30 million. Then $90 wow. million. Dollars.
Very impressive.
And then $300 million. Dollars. And then $900 million. So in 4 years, we'd grown from almost zero, $9 million to $900 million. It was a fantastic problem.
I was going to say, it's an incredible story, but how many years did it take you to get to that 9 million? 20, whatever?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, like something, right?
A slow burn to begin with.
Yeah. But then when it hits. What do you think led to, because obviously you were correct in assuming the US was an impressive market. I don't think anyone would disagree knowing now. Yeah. But what do you think really led to your success? Was it a certain mindset of the people that worked in the organization to try new things, or was it just perseverance, tenacity? Was it aligning with the right people? In your opinion, what do you think led to that success?
Well, I mean, you've mentioned it yourself. It took 20 years to get to that. And then an absolute rocket for 5 years, and then a bit of a learner. But, well, it takes perseverance. You're quite right. That 20 years, you go through numerous pieces of hell and back again. Yeah. But, you know, you've got to keep positive and you've got to keep going. You know?
Yeah.
When one door shuts, another door opens, and you've got to keep pushing and doing it. And I think it's all that determination because, okay, when we got there and then when we got aerobics, it wasn't a matter of where do you get the next order from. It was a matter of how do we fulfill these orders. This was fantastic. What was happening? It's like okay, maybe from 9 to 30 million wasn't a big jump as far as product was concerned. But when he got from 300 to 900, that's immense. And so there's a degree of luck here. And, you know, when you're having that success, also your team is feeling right. It's feeling good. The right people join you. And you have a culture. You have that winning culture. So whichever way, you know, you brush aside the problems. But luck came along in many, many times in many different ways. Okay, you can say we had bad luck in certain ways. But, you know, we changed our name. Was Reebok better than Mercury? We think so. Adidas, after 4 years being in business, complained because we had two stripes and a T-bar. And we were worried, they wrote a letter. And, you know, we'd been in business 4 years, and the lawyers wrote a letter, and we, you know, for 5 minutes we were destroyed. And then we thought, just a minute, Adidas know we're here. They know we're around. You know, they think we're a bit of a challenge because they don't like what we're doing. That's great. Okay.
That's great.
We'll change our stripe. We'll put the vector on, you know, the things on the book there behind me. We'll put the vector on, and so our silhouette changed, a better silhouette. And, you know, numerous things have progressed as you go on, and you have the vision for it. Why don't we do this? And so that progression, it can be slow to begin with, because getting everybody to, it's like getting everybody to read my book now. You know, it's progression is slow. We got to get them there. But, you know, once it clicks, we're going to get to number one. That happened. Yeah. And for 20 years, that growth was slow. But I was knocking on that door for 10, 11 years. I need this market. And, you know, if I'd gone too soon, maybe we'd have missed the running market. I don't know. You know, would we have seen the aerobics market? Would we have had our help? So the timing is the timing. And that's, you know, if you're around long enough, maybe the timing is there all the time. Maybe you will run into the timing. But, you know, we were there. The timing was right. And during that massive growth, we were lucky.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, HubSpot. Now, with the year end fast approaching, HubSpot's CRM is ready to take on challenges of keeping you, your teams, and your customers connected in 2022. With the improved forecasting tool, you get a bird's eye view of your entire pipeline to see what's around the corner. You learn how your quarter's doing, inspect new deals, and also you can use customizable data-driven reports to improve team performance as you grow. And on top of the improved forecasting tools, you also have the option for the custom report builder. And with the custom report builder, you are leveling up from manually entering data. You're letting HubSpot connect smarter, cleaner data into real-time reporting on sales, marketing, deals, and more. Now, if you want to learn more about the improved forecasting tool, if you want to learn more about custom report builders, or if you just want to learn more about HubSpot as a CRM for your business, go to HubSpot.com and learn about how HubSpot CRM can help connect your business in 2022, HubSpot.com.
To go from 300 to 900, because Nike at that time, Nike had been doing fantastic, but they just hit a glitch. It just, all of a sudden, the sales dropped. No idea why. Maybe they'd been overselling or whatever, but they were overstocked, and they had to pull out of 3 manufacturing units in Korea, just as we needed them. And that was the only way that we could have managed to go from 300 to 900. So again, a bit of luck, and we managed to get the product. Financing, that had been a product in the early days. But Stephen Rubin of Pentland, he sourced out of the Far East. And so he gave us a credit line. And that's all that Paul needed to expand the company. So, you know, yes, a lot of stick with it. You know, just stick with it. Yeah. You have a belief that you can do it. Plus, you know, maybe clever people think this is, you know, I can do something easier. I don't know. Yeah, but it was a fantastic ride. Yeah, we it was absolutely fabulous. And the fact that we had this tremendous growth down in Los Angeles, Hollywood took it on from Jane Fonda. We got lots of stars in the shoes. And then we started to do the Princess Grace tennis tournaments in Monte Carlo. and all the stars were coming in there. Even Frank Sinatra came in on one occasion to be part of this this show, and it was great. So we got to know so many stars, and they were influencers. And in those days, all we needed to do was to take them to Monte Carlo, give them shoes, and we were seen everywhere. So yes, we were influencing. We're influencing street. We were becoming fashion. And really today, that's where Reebok, Nike, and Adidas are. They're fashion companies. And influencers, now influencing is a profession. People make a lot of money out of just influencing. So life has changed. And, you know, we now have this. I used to travel miles and miles and air miles. I must have had too many air miles. All I had was a bunch of American Express traveler's checks, and I'd jump onto Pan Am or TWA in those days, and I'd fly wherever the next exhibition was, show, or people I was interested in meeting, and it was going around. And I left the company. I retired at the end of 1989, because at that time, I'd put on America, I'd put on 30 other different distributors around the world, and I got to the point where I'm at 35,000 feet. For most of the month, and I'm picked up at the airports by a limousine, and I'm taken to the best hotels, and we dine at the best restaurants. But I'm thinking, no, the challenge is over. You know, this is not a challenge. This is, I need to sort of move backwards, which I did. But you know, the story I tell on moving out of Reebok is the one of the Eagles and Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave.
You can never leave.
That was it. You can never leave. And so I'm still sort of very, very much involved with Reebok people. And now, since Adidas are selling the company, it's going to be a very interesting future. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, no, likewise. And thank you for, you know, really going into detail about the story, but also providing some insights, just some of the lessons you learned over your career. It was a hard run. It was like a hard run for sure. But I think that some of the things that you've learned are like universally applicable to entrepreneurs. And I think it's just some very smart lessons there that people are looking to do their own thing. You need to put in that grind. You need to put in that time before, you know, I think a lot of people actually make something of their business before the 20-year mark. So I think you actually had it more difficult than most, but still, there's a lesson there for sure. What was I going to say? I want to finish with some rapid fire questions just to bring in some insight from you, on top of obviously all the stuff that we've already spoken about. But just a question. Did you ever at any point think of giving up or quitting, or was this just what you were dead set on doing?
I think you have to be dead set. I think if you've got hesitancy, if you've got a problem, you know, get out very early. I think it's something you just got to be probably blinded by, something that is just you may call it stupid. It probably was. My wife used to say to me, Joe, why don't you get a decent job? And I'm saying, well, you know, I'd rather like this.
Good question. Some days.
I think you, if you have any hesitancy, I think it's, I think that's fatal. I think you've got to have full belief. Certainly, if you're going to take the 20 years plus, you're going to trip. Yeah. United. And you know, even though some of the times it was only small increments, some of the time we were nearly out of business. When our UK distributor went out of business and nearly took us out of business as well, you know, there are some of those days where you wonder. But yeah, you know, we had a strong feeling of winning. You know, we were there, and then I say the race isn't over until you've won. Yeah, so you just keep going, That was our attitude. And Jeff loved to work in the factory. Unfortunately, he died. He died just as we got to America. We just got the agreement, just got things going with Paul, but he died of stomach cancer. He was a runner, but he used to run too far, too much, pushed himself too hard. And I think that probably causes problems. But and at that point, things did change. It was difficult, but you get by. And, you know, I was never left with the feeling, what do I do next? I was always left with the feeling, it's a change. I've got to change something and keep moving. And I think that's it. I guess it could be bad if you're desolate and you sit down and you don't know what to do. You know, I always had an answer. I always had something to try, something else. We'll keep going. And so keeping going was the essential thing. And then when you get the rewards, I mean, the rewards we had were tremendous. And the journey was fantastic. And meeting all those people and doing things, it was incredible. But, you know,
amazing.
We got lucky.
Amazing. All right. I want to go through some rapid fire questions for you. And you can go as short or as long as you'd like on these. The biggest challenge that you have experienced over your career, and how did you overcome it? It could have been a personal or business. What is one that stood out?
I guess the biggest challenge really was when Jeff died. I guess that was the fact that there were two things that came out of it. One, I was destroyed that I lost a brother and a work companion. But the other side was, you know, if there was any decisions, anything I had to discuss with people, because, you know, your wives become part of a team when there's two of you and two. You know, all of a sudden, this became me 100%. So the benefit, you know, it doesn't outweigh the problems. I'd have wished that Jeff could have been here. Even today, you know, he would have been 2 years older than me. He would have been 88. But you've got to then take those decisions. So that was the biggest thing in my life, was taking decisions immediately and changing things. Not a lot, but changing it so I could work with it. So that was the biggest one.
Very good. Who would be one person, and it may be the same answer, I don't know, so excuse me if I'm just reiterating the same question, but I was going to ask you, one person who's had the biggest impact on your life, and what did they teach you?
Well, there were a number of people who had impacts on my life. Probably the biggest impact was when we were very small, and I'm going around to auctions because the shoe industry in the UK, it was being destroyed because things were coming in from the Far East. And so there was too much competition from the Far East price-wise. And companies were going out of business. And all the businesses were being auctioned off. And I used to go around to the auctions to see if I could buy cheap machinery or whatever. And I met a man there who, he was there on every one of the sales. And he had a rather large factory about 10 miles, 15 miles away from where we were in Bury. And we got talking. And I just told him I had trouble on the auction before. I'd bought too much leather, and my van that I was in was like more like a speedball trying to go up the motorway. And the police had pulled me over and said, no, 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 come on, and weighed me, and I was too heavy. So I got a fine. I told the guy was called John Willie Johnson, and I told John about this. I said, John, last time I said, he said, Joe, he said, don't bother. He said, if you buy anything, my men will pick it up. He had a truck, and people, you know, he would do the sale. He'd tell the men to go down and pick up. He said, my men will pick stuff up. And then he said, why don't we're always at these sales together. Why don't we go together next time? And, you know, I said, okay, I'll pick you up. And he said, no, 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 we'll go in my car. He'd seen my car. However, I went over to his place, and he took me through his factory. He knew everybody's name. Everybody on every machine, and he asked how the wife was, how the children. And then I said, John, what do you do with all this stuff that you buy at these sales? Because he didn't buy anything. If the auctioneer couldn't find a buyer, he would look down at John, and John would just nod, and that would become his. It could be anything. And he had stuffed birds. He'd buy a stuffed bird, which was in the office, or even a stuffed crocodile. You know, amazing, everything. I said, what do you do with it? He said, come and have a look. So it went into, he had another large building just full of everything he just bought, all this stuff. And considering it, he probably bought it for next to nothing. It was probably, yeah. Did he want it? No, he didn't want it. But on occasions, he'd find stuff to use. And I spotted a machine in the corner, a pounding up machine, which to us, you wouldn't understand a pounding up machine unless you're in the shoe industry. But it knocks the wrinkles out of it when you've lasted at all. It knocks all the wrinkles out so it looks nice and smooth. And I said to him, John, I see that machinery, that machine there. Can I buy it off you? And he said, no. Oh, can I rent it then? Said, no. Oh, okay, John. He said, Joe, he said, you can have it. He said, just give it me back when you're done with it. Oh, right. Thank you, John. And not only that, his men brought the machine down to our small factory, put it on the production line, wired it up, set it going. And any time I wanted a machine, I could go along, and if John had one, you can have it. Just let me have it back when you've done with it. So for me, that was wonderful. The guy would, he would help. He would give. He was so generous that whatever I wanted, if I'd have asked him for anything, I'm sure, I think he almost went out of his way to buy a property because we were looking to change from our, and he almost, and I said, no, John, it's okay, we found one. Yeah, but he was just so generous. So that generosity, amazing. I've not seen in anybody, but it was major.
No, that's incredible. That is truly incredible. If you could tell your 20-year-old self one thing, what would that thing be?
The problem with advice when you're 20 is don't listen to much. Don't listen to advice. Believe in yourself. If you listen to advice, you'll probably not do it, because most advice is to tell you the downsides, not the upsides. Most people with the advice, you know, they've either failed in doing what they did or they've succeeded in doing something else. And that advice probably won't relate to what you're trying to do, you know, because it'll tell you all the problems. And mm-hmm. you know, so be careful with the advice. Just trust in yourself. Trust in the fact that you're young.
Yeah.
You're indestructible.
I love that.
And what can go wrong? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if it does, pick yourself up. Start again. You're young. That's the important thing. At 20 years old, yes, young. So what?
What would be, besides your own, what would be a book or a podcast that you'd recommend people go check out?
The recent podcast is Sneakonomics. I don't know if you've heard of Sneakonomics.
No, I haven't. That's a new one.
Yeah, well, look it up on Twitter. Is it on Twitter?
No, it's on Spotify or Apple.
Spotify BBC. Or what?
Apple or BBC.
Or Apple.
Spotify, Apple, or BBC.
It's made by
the BBC, and it's called Sneakonomics. Yeah, I star in it at some point.
Good. Okay, that's a good one. I've never heard about it. Okay, that's great. So we'll put that in the show notes too. So what do you speak about?
It's dramatized quite a lot of it, and it's just really a documentary, if you will. And it's a lot of it is about the Adidas Puma fighting, and then the Adidas fight with Nike and that, and it brings Reebok in. So and they dramatize that bit where I pick up my dictionary. Where I've been, why am I getting a dictionary? I'm only 8 years old. Why am I getting a dictionary? And it really is very interesting. We found it very interesting, but maybe. But
that's a great recommendation. Thank you. That's a new one. It's a new one. That's
9 episodes to it, and they're each about 45 good. Minutes. So, and it's good. Yes.
And then last question, and then I'm going to get some socials and some website links from you. But what does success mean to you?
Fun. Enjoyment. I was asked what are the three most important things that you do in your business, and it was have fun, and then have more fun, and have a lot more fun. Because if you're not having fun, you're not enjoying it. So I think success is something that I don't say you would expect it. It is a bonus. It is that something that you've worked so long that you can look back on and have the satisfaction of saying, yeah, I enjoyed that. That was really good.
Amazing. And then most importantly, so where can people go find Shoemaker? Your website, your social, all of that, and then we'll also put it in the show notes.
We're on all the social platforms. That's LinkedIn, Twitter,
Facebook,
Instagram. We're on all those.
As Reebok the founder.
Reebok the founder.
You can find us, and you can find our book, good bookshops, all good bookshops, or on Amazon. Amazon have the book. They have it in, they have the book, they have the Kindle, and they also have audio.
Perfect. Okay, so Reebok the founder, and then Amazon, Kindle, anywhere they want to go find books, and we'll link all those links below.
Anyway.
Perfect.
Yes.
All right. That's all I got. That's perfect. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Scott. It's been a pleasure. And I hope people sort of get a bit inspired if they can do. And I know from people who tell us that they enjoyed the book because it did inspire them. And it wasn't written to inspire people. It was written to tell the story. And I'm really delighted.
But if a story inspires, if a story inspires, then it's just a very good story.
That's a good bonus too. That's fantastic. Yes. So yeah, we're after getting this to number one in our bestseller in on the American market. That's what the next target is.
You'll get there. I have no doubt you'll get there. Because if you put 20 years in to dominating a shoe industry, I have a feeling that getting a book to a number one bestseller is going to be easy work for you. But like you said, you're not going to give up till you get there anyways.
That's right.
So this is all good.
That's it. We don't stop till we've won. Excellent. Thank you, Scott. Been a pleasure.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours. That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive. And I bet you we've all been there. And maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real, there are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks, or accounting professionals to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.